Boys Guide to the Galaxy podcast, the official podcast of GalacticVoyage.com. We talk about Star Wars,
fanboy style.
You've taken your first step into a larger world.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another exciting episode of Fanboy's Guide to the Galaxy. I'm one of your hosts, Ryan Zasso, and with me, of course, is my co-host, Eric.
Hello there.
And then this week, we've got a great crossover episode. We've got the crew from the Bothan Report, Riley and Bethany.
Hello.
Welcome, guys.
Hey, everybody.
Many Bothans, well, you know the story.
Today, we're going to be talking about the sphere of influence, and Eric and I were just talking earlier about the meaning of the title and really how my interpretation of it was the cycle of persuasion, you know, how it goes from the Separatists, you know, being in control and sort of persuading, you know, Pantor to join the Separatists, but, you know, then the tables are sort of turned on them and it's, you know, the other way around.
Yeah.
So was that your interpretation as well?
Very, very Phantom Menace-like, if you will.
Right.
Yeah, actually, a lot of parallels to the Phantom Menace. There's a Trade Federation blockade, and people are being kidnapped. A lot of parallels there.
Mm-hmm. And Anakin and Padme reference Episode 1.
That is true. Anakin, I believe that at some point the line is something like, I believe Padme's talking about how she really feels for the Pantorans because of what happened to Naboo back in Episode 1, and Anakin's like, well, it's not all bad. We kind of got together, which I guess, a little bit of silver lining, I guess, in Anakin Skywalker's viewpoint. But yeah, it's a very good episode. It's not really, I don't think it was one of the landmark episodes of the Clone Wars so far, but it certainly did introduce, in my opinion, one of the best characters. But I'm sure we'll get to that.
Well, first, the episode starts out, and I believe that they're in the Senate, and they're talking about the blockade on Pantora.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the Federation pretty much blockades everybody, but it's interesting how they can sort of maintain their neutrality here, or their image of neutrality in the Senate. How do you think they do that? Because, you know, you got pretty much in every single movie, or prequel movie, and then in most of the Clone Wars, you can obviously tell that the Federation is behind, you know, most of the Separatist attacks.
Truly, I think it's Palpatine's influence. I mean, I am the Senate, you know?
I am the Senate. No,
thank you, Riley.
You can definitely see Palpatine's fingerprints all over this, even though he's not even in the episode. You can just feel Palpatine back there behind Lot Dodd. You're right. Right in the episode, we come straight into a senatorial dispute. And as a viewer, we know how evil the Nemoidians are. And and I think sometimes we actually felt like Palpatine did in Episode 1. And we're just like, get this stunted slime out of my sight. You know, but you can definitely see Palpatine's influence. Now, I thought it was fascinating what you brought up, Eric. And that is... Ryan, I need to get the names right here. Sorry about that. But right at the beginning, they are trying to maintain an image of neutrality as the Trade Federation. The Trade Federation still has representation in the Senate. Now, if I may, I'm going to try to be all fancy here and play a clip because I thought this little section here was very telling. Here it is.
In this, but Pantora must pay its debt before we can resume commerce with the system.
That is a lie. It is well known that the Trade Federation is aligned with the Separatists.
Slanderous. We are not Separatists simply because we do business with them. How many times must I remind you of the Commerce Treaty of 1647?
But yeah, very interesting. Trying to maintain a distance between the Separatists and the Trade Federation. And we all know that their hands are dirty. We all know that they're slimy bad guys. But they're still maintaining this kind of frontal image.
Right. And towards the end, they even sort of blame their, you know, some of the Federation's, you know, acts towards, you know, to pro-Separatists on Nuke Gunray. They say, you know, Nuke Gunray has, you know, reared his ugly head again to the Separatists, and or something to that effect. And I think that's sort of how they've managed to maintain, you know, on sort of the neutrality there, which it's interesting.
The season 2 episode, the title, I don't know what the title is, but I remember it was about Padme, and she was going undercover to the Trade Federation with that one, with her ex-boyfriend. And
Senate Spy.
Yeah, Senate Spy. Lot Dodd was in that episode, and we find out that he really is, that the Trade Federation really is in League of the Separatists.
Right. I think that this one is a prequel to that, if I'm remembering right, or if I'm just guessing right.
I know, it's kind of confusing. Something that the Forest cast has brought up a lot, and I love what they do on their roundtable, but Jason brought up once that I think it bothers him very much, this timeline issue, as they keep jumping around. So I was going to kind of bring it up on this show. What are your guys' takes? Do you like it when they jump around on the timeline and do all these prequels and sequels and kind of jump around, or do you find that confusing?
I think it's good. It really depends. I like it when they can bring back, you know, dead characters like they did in the premiere episode where they brought back, you know, Heavy, who was obviously killed in the episode Rookies. I think that works really well. I think that there's a lot more room for characters that maybe might have been a character favorite that might have, you know, died. But it is confusing. I do have to admit. It bothers me, but not, you know, really bothers me.
Yeah, it does make it makes for an interesting kind of game, if you will. I think on one hand, it's fun to kind of look at the episodes and figure out where they are, and as a Star Wars fan, we usually get it figured out pretty well. We're on the StarWars.com episode guides, and they let us know. But I can imagine, especially for the more casual viewer, how that could become a problem.
Well, for the more casual viewer, there are also these, you know, trilogies, two-parters, three-parters, four-parters, and those tie in really well together. So I think there's a pretty good balance.
It doesn't bother me too much. Except for on a visual standpoint, they look a lot different. Like when you have a season 1 episode and then a season 3 episode, and you watch those back to back, it looks way different. But if you watch them from season 1 to season 2 to season 3, you can't really tell the changes unless you watch them back to back.
So you mean like if you stuck them all in chronological order, then it would get kind of weird?
Yeah.
Visually speaking.
Baron Papanoia. Okay, so obviously, he's George Lucas's cameo appearance in Revenge of the Sith. And to be honest, I think we were all expecting, you know, George to do the voice, or at least wanting him to. But it turns out it was Corey Burton, who is, you know, he's pretty much a lot of the major characters in Clone Wars. So what'd you guys think of his voice? I know they tried to make it sound like Orson Welles.
I thought it would be great. It's really believable, because now when I watch George Lucas interviews, I expect him to sound like that. It's weird.
Yeah. I liked it quite a bit, and it wasn't too far different from George Lucas's voice to make it, like, you know, cringe, because you're expecting to hear Lucas's voice, and you get something, like, high-pitched and whiny. Fortunately, it was not that. So, I think Corey Burton did an awesome job.
Yeah,
he did
the
action hero sound. You know, George Lucas doesn't really have the voice chops to really carry the character, although I do really kind of wish that it had been. Part of me really likes, or would have liked, George Lucas to do the voice, but the other part of me realizes if they're really going to flesh out Baron Papanoida as a character and kind of make him into the awesome hero that he was, it did probably take maybe a slightly different voice.
Right. And, you know, going along with that, with what you just said about, you know, the character, I think that almost by having Corey Burton do the voice, I think it almost blended him better in the story. I mean, just as a character. And I think that, you know, he really did, you know, belong in the story. And you know, maybe it would have been a little bit more of a distraction.
Drop your weapons.
We're going to talk to Java about this.
Awesome. Yeah, you kidnap my daughter. I'll get you. Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I could see how that would be very distracting.
I'll tell you what. So, let me talk about Baron Papanoida. grab some popcorn, folks. This guy...
Riley loves Baron Papadoido, by the way.
This guy is an incredible character. The Clone Wars have introduced a number of really good, solid characters. Star Wars-y characters, if you will. Someone that just seems to fit right in with the Star Wars universe. As an example...
Amen, brother.
For an example, I really liked the character of Zero the Hutt. It was not another Jabba the Hutt copy, but they really fleshed out the character of Zero.
Literally.
To where you really could get a feel for where Zero was coming from. You heard his voice, you saw his atmosphere, and you could tell where this Hutt crime lord came from. I'd say the same case with Cad Bane, another very successful and popular character. Cad Bane was a very original. He wasn't a copy of yet another bounty hunter that's already existed, but really seems to fit right in with the Star Wars universe. And you can identify who Cad Bane is, where he's coming from, what he's all about. Here we go. But yeah, Cad Bane, another great character. And so following that suit, I think Baron Papanoida is one of the best Clone Wars characters that they've introduced yet. And I think he's particularly culturally relevant at this time. And because, face it, if you live in the United States right now, we are in a time of a lot of political unrest. No matter which side of politics you happen to tend towards, we are in times where politics is at the forefront of our minds. It's almost at the November elections. And a common thought in our own world is that politicians are slime balls, and politicians are not very well liked. Politician is not exactly a career that people think is a fine, upstanding thing. And
let's just say we're all like Obi-Wan.
Yeah,
in that
exactly. We're kind of feeling like Obi-Wan does about politicians in our own world, and probably with some good reason in some cases. But Baron Papanoida was really humanized in this episode. As a politician, he was a breath of fresh air in the Star Wars universe. The no good, what is it, Chandivo? You know what I'm talking about, the Barney Fife, the clumsy klutz of a cop that was introduced last season. We all know he's not getting anything done. And the Jedi are the Jedi. They're busy fighting a war. And so this fellow takes matters into his own hands and goes to rescue his own family. It was a really, really humanizing moment for the character, and I really liked the way that they handled it. I thought it was perfectly balanced. It wasn't over-the-top action hero, but his performance, Corey Burton's performance, had so many layers to it. It really, really fleshed out what was a brief cameo into now a really, really fabulous character for the Clone Wars.
And really a good role model, you know, for the kid watchers of the show.
Riley and Chandivo, and I just gotta say something about him. He's a terrible cop. He needs to learn how to do his job, because there's a scene in this episode where they head back to the apartment, Baron and Ion, and Chandivo walks out with the police droids, and he comes out empty-handed. But within a few seconds, Baron Papanoida finds the moon goddess thing, the trophy-like thing.
Right.
With like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And Devo couldn't find that at all.
Right.
Yeah.
That's just how the Baron works.
Beat off by Greedo.
Yeah, I thought that he was more of, you know, the pure, you know, good politician, sort of like Bail Organa.
Yeah.
I thought that, yeah, he was very similar to him. So.
Yeah, I mean, just to see him at the end of the episode just, you know, taking names, and the Mos Eisley Cantina at the end there had a very classic spaghetti western feel to it, when he was rolling tables, dodging chairs, and blasters were going everywhere, and he was in the thick of it, and he pulls out those two blasters, so he just
Clint Eastwood style,
make my day, or however Corey Burton would say it. I almost expected that.
Yeah, right. I think, yeah, with the spaghetti western, I think they're trying to go back even to, you know, the original Star Wars, where you could argue that what Han did was sort of like a spaghetti western too. If you've ever seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I mean, Lee Van Cleef shoots the guy right on from under the table. I think that is very similar.
A lot of callbacks, not just to older franchises, which is something that the Clone Wars has done quite a bit. We've seen callbacks to Godzilla, we've seen callbacks to Alfred Hitchcock, all kinds of stuff, but now callbacks to the original trilogy, back to the old movies. We saw a lot of familiar locations. We returned to Tatooine, Jabba's Palace, and the Mos Eisley Cantina, a lot of familiar locations. And I was going to ask you, Bethany, real quick, if I may, what did you think of some of the locations here? Did they translate well into animation?
I thought so. I thought the episode was very visually appealing. I really liked going back to Tatooine, and Mos Eisley especially.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of when you see Jabba's Palace, they're not nearly as well populated because I don't think they can afford to have all the character models. But you got to see Jabba's Palace with the Twi'lek Dancer. It was a very familiar kind of location. And another interesting aspect of it was Baron Papanoida seemed to be kind of chummy with Jabba the Hutt there, and even appealed to him as a father. And it kind of brings me to something that I've been thinking about after seeing this episode, and that is Jabba the Hutt in the Clone Wars so far has been radically different than he has been in Return of the Jedi, in A New Hope Special Edition, and especially in the Expanded Universe. I wonder if it's from George or if it's from Dave Filoni, but he's really more softer. It's like the end of the Clone Wars movie. I was just kind of scratching my head because he Rod of the Hutt, hugs him and he's making all these happy noises, and that's the end of the movie. That's the happy ending, is that the Hutt slime ball got his son back that I hated throughout the movie anyway. And I like the Clone Wars movie, but it really, really shone a different light on Jabba the Hutt. And if anything, I would say the role of Jabba the Hutt, or at least his character style, was kind of transferred over to Zero. So Jabba the Hutt has really been different. He actually finds out that, if I'm remembering this correctly, that Greedo kidnapped them, and Jabba the Hutt's ready to go for blood. He's just like, get Greedo out of here, which is a kind of sense of justice, or at least some kind of maybe Hutt honor code or something. But Jabba the Hutt really, really seems to be maybe a different take. I wonder if that's from George.
Right.
I wonder if they just wanted to sort of give him more character than just the evil bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, he has, you know, a young Hutt under his wing. I think he's probably more trying to make an example. Follow what I do, and
yeah,
you know, you'll end up okay.
A little bit.
So
maybe softened a little bit because he's a father now. It before it becomes a grouchy old Hutt,
right?
In the end days, but yeah.
Maybe his son passes away, and then he's just really pissed off about that in Return of the Jedi.
That is a thought.
Maybe. While we're doing speculation here, Ahsoka has to assassinate. No, never mind. That wouldn't work.
I was really wondering where that was going too.
Never mind.
Maybe his son is Jabba in Return of the Jedi.
Oh, and assumes his identity. Oh my!
Dun,
I think.
Dun, dun.
You got to be writing these episodes. It's a trap.
Speaking of writing, I thought Katie Lucas did a great, great job. I really enjoyed this episode. I really hope that she comes back to write more.
I believe she is actually, but yes, Katie Lucas. Right. Writing Star Wars, and very interesting.
Yeah.
Speaking of son or father-daughter relationships. Not that I'm trying to compare Lucas to Jabba the Hutt there. That kind of came out wrong.
Let's talk about Chi Ekwe and Chi Emanwe. Mm. What did you guys get out of these characters?
I thought the whole Papanoida family was very interesting. They're obviously very chummy, very handy with the blaster. But I believe the voices were done by Meredith Salinger, Seth Green, and if I remember right, Jennifer Hale. No, Jennifer Hale.
Nika Futterman.
Futterman, thank you. Jennifer Hale did the voice of Senator Chuchi, which is a whole other topic. But no, I really liked the way that the Papanoida family was portrayed. They were very close. They liked each other. And I really liked the kind of dynamic of the sons looked a little bit more impetuous, and he was like he was talking to I believe it was Count Dooku. Yeah, it was Count Dooku who was offering his resources as maybe a little bit of a quid pro quo. If we, it will help you find your family if you think about maybe joining us. So, yeah, I thought that was very interesting. Maybe a little bit more impetuous than his dad, who was a little bit more morally upright and was like, who needs Count Dooku? I got my twin blasters. Let's go.
Did any of you guys get a Grimace vibe from Chiekwe? No Grimace from McDonald's?
Huh.
Just the shape of her. I don't know why. It kind of reminded me of Grimace.
Perhaps maybe a little bit, yeah.
All right. Let's see. What about that guy who had the goat voice? I mean, that kind of... Did that take you out of the experience at all?
Man, that was cool.
It's fun to do.
Stop it!
That's right.
I thought it was cool.
The guy with the goat voice. No, I'm trying to think of his name. Oh, yes, I can't believe I blanked. I keep wanting to call him Rodian. Greedo. Greedo's cohorts, as they kidnap the Papanoides family. And I won't try to bother to pronounce their names. You have that down, Eric, but I don't yet.
Yeah, neither do I.
Yeah, the goat guy. It was obvious, but I thought it was a nice little play there. It didn't really take me too much out of the episode.
You got this suspenseful scene where you don't know what happened to the other sister, and then out of the darkness all you hear is, bah!
Yeah, it's true. It's a trap! Yeah. Yeah, I can kind of see why that might be the case, but I thought it was interesting. Greedo was also a whole subject of this thing.
Right.
A lot of continuity stuff, but shoving that aside, because I'm not really big on continuity. As a matter of fact, let me take this little aside here. I don't have no idea if you guys have listened to our latest episode.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I have to apologize right on air. We used your show. I hope you, gotta be
no,
your lawyer
okay.
Come after us. I'll talk to my people, make sure we got the rights there. Oh yeah, we used audio from your show of Mark, and we were talking about continuity some, but yeah, that was it was an adventure. But yeah, there you go. But yes, speaking of Greedo, wow, some really interesting dynamics. There's one moment where I really was kind of hit over the head a little bit. I was surprised enough in season two when there was kind of a hinted romantic past between Ara Sing. And, help me remember his name, Bethany. What was his name? I can't believe I blanked.
Are we talking about Hondo?
Thank you. Hondo and Naka. But, yeah, I kind of hinted romantic relationship between those two.
Right.
And so they kind of carried that yet another step when they went to Jabba's palace, and one of the dancers there seemed to... A little bam-chicka-bam-bam with Greedo. You know? I was genuinely surprised and, quite frankly, a little perturbed, shall we say, at that.
Creeped out.
Yeah, I wasn't going
to
be that off.
To put it mildly.
Yeah. I thought it was a very, very interesting little twist there.
Wasn't the first interspecies erotica we've seen in Clone Wars. There was, in the second season, the clone with the Twi'lek.
Oh, yeah, the cut scene there.
The pink Twi'lek.
Yeah, I put this on our Twitter, but yeah, I was thinking to myself, I can see why they cut that scene, but if I was going to cut a scene, I would cut the Greedo scene. I don't know, it was so different than his character was. He actually seemed kind of competent in this episode. He did successfully kidnap Senator's children. That's pretty hard to do. If anybody's seen Attack of the Clones, you usually take some creepy bugs to do that. And they weren't even successful when they did that. So Greedo seems actually to be a pretty decent bounty hunter. I think this
Greedo in his prime.
Yeah, the traditional assumption is that Greedo is just a nobody and he just pretends to be a bounty hunter. No one. That's why. How could he miss Han Solo at point blank range? But maybe there's another layer to that scene because Dave Filoni and GL seem to kind of put a different twist on Greedo.
If that were true. That really enlarges Han's character as well to, you know, went out in a fight with Greedo if he's a higher caliber bounty hunter than we had always assumed.
It's obviously, in the cantina, it's obviously Greedo's clone, Greedo.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he's got a little bit of clone madness going on. Can't fight, not very well oriented. Probably missed. It's all explained now.
Right. All right. So what about Greedo? I thought that the voice work was good. It's the same. I believe it's the same voice actor that did the voice for Kit Fisto's Padawan back in season one, Nadar. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, it was well done, I thought, but I was surprised to hear him speak English. Actually,
oh,
I guess right. They've really had. I don't think there's been any really non-alien language spoken that, and when they aren't subtitled anyway.
Right.
Well, I think it's because a large number of the audience is children, and
yeah,
many of them can't read or can't read fast enough to get what it says.
That could be the case. And, yeah, Greedo was definitely some very interesting layers to him. I wonder if they'll return to Greedo. I would be personally interested to see. I like to see those original trilogy connections, and this episode was certainly jam-packed with them.
I mean, they certainly left it open, because, you know, instead of having him arrested or something, you just see him running out the door. So, it's certainly, you know, not out of a possibility.
But if he was arrested, he could have gone to prison with Boba Fett, and they could have escaped together.
Very interesting. Or we all know right now those are the weird conversations going on between Bosk and Boba Fett as they are stuck in their prison cell right now. But I'm actually looking at the episode guide now. Another interesting thing I saw at Jabba's palace was in the background you get to see Sugi from the episode Bounty Hunters in the last season, and the Zabrak female. I like that character, but also one of my favorite characters from season two, Imbo.
Yeah,
Jabba's palace. Very, very.
He was also in Mos Eisley Cantina. He was like following.
He's kind of hanging out back there. But Imbo, the amazing hat dude, El Sombrero de Muerte, the Sombrero of Death. For those of you who don't speak Spanish, but. No, the guy, I love him in the season two, and so it was really cool to see him return, even though he wasn't in a main role. And he is just kind of hanging out there in the background, not much to do. But I thought it was surprising, because in the season two episode, they kind of painted those bounty hunters as kind of with a certain honor code. That, you know, they weren't going to work for Hondo just because he'd pay them more. They're going to work for the farmers who originally hired them. They're just kind of a bounty hunter code of honor. And so they were kind of painted in a more positive light. They're fighting on the sides of the good guys. And so to see him hanging out in a seedy area like Jabba the Hutt's palace was definitely a little bit of an odd place, although I was glad to see him anyway.
Right.
What happened?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think bounty hunters.
Noida hired him to watch his back at Mos Eisley. That's why he was in both places. We didn't see it during the commercial.
I think you're uncovering something, Eric. I like it.
All right. Well, we jumped around a lot, so let's get back to where we were, and that was when they're on the platform, the landing platform on Coruscant, Anakin says, the Jedi cannot get involved, this is a job for local police, and, I mean, I did not catch that until the second time I watched it, but that it has a lot of weight to it, considering that Obi-Wan said that exact same thing in Attack of the Clones, and it shows that how much... That's what I like about Clone Wars. It can show how much they've progressed in between the movies, and it also shows what Anakin's Ahsoka's reaction to that. You know, shows how she's mirroring Anakin's training.
It shows Anakin's arrogance. I mean, ignorance, not arrogance.
Oh, crap. Yeah, that's very interesting. Ahsoka in this episode was very well developed, I thought, but it. An interesting moment was between her and Padme. Padme almost kind of has a motherly advice for her of giving her some advice on diplomacy and stuff in that scene. And then Ahsoka leaves, and she looks over at Anakin, and she's like, I can't believe they let you teach.
I know, I love that line.
Which is funny, because I think that's what a lot of the audience is thinking. Because, you know, ever since everybody was shocked, Anakin has a what? And so it's kind of voicing what the audience is thinking. Something kind of along the lines of Jar Jar, I think. A lot of the, you know how many people hate Jar Jar, a really interesting perspective on him is that nobody in the films in-universe really likes Jar Jar either. He's kind of the ultimately hated character, which I think is kind of what makes him unique.
I like Jar Jar. Sniff.
I think it's hip to like Jar Jar now.
Yeah, it's cultural now. You have to like it. You have to embrace it.
Yeah, we should, yeah. We should start wearing T-shirts Misa back with the animated.
All right, Eric, do you have any, what other points do you have?
Well, this was on the Separatist ship. The Nemodians' helmets, they resemble Darth Vader's helmets a lot, except for the spike on it. You know, the top part of Vader's helmet? It looked a lot like that.
It's true.
A lot of really cool homages visually to original trilogy stuff as well. And it's amazing how much of the Ralph McQuarrie art that they'll incorporate. Stuff that was never used, but still has the look and feel of the original trilogy. And then you know why, because they are using original concept art. That's, I think, what made Pandora look so cool. The original Pandora planet. I keep wanting to call it Pandora. Wonder why. But, yeah, that it looked amazing. And it was Ralph McQuarrie concepts of Ha. And a little bit of a different look there. So it's really cool visuals added to it.
Another point was that if you've ever read any of the original Marvel Star Wars comics, you'll notice that the original Jabba the Hutt is the bartender at the Mos Eisley Cantina.
I caught that. Yeah.
Yeah. You see, I'm not familiar with the Marvel comics, but I heard that. I think that's kind of a cool homage as well, yeah.
And another thing was that Baron Pepinoid's ship looked kind of like the Slave One. There was a lot of differences, but it kind of looked like it.
I can see that, yeah.
But those Neomoidian officers are up aboard the Trade Federation ship thing. it seems like they're not all aligned with the Separatists. I mean, there's some that are, you know, more hesitant, I think, than, you know, to join them. There, you know, there's some that are really like, you know, Separatists, you know, we belong to them. And there's others like, you know, we're just businessmen and we're just doing our job. So, what are your thoughts on, like, some of the Neomoidians that really aren't part of the Separatists? Do you think that they're the ones that help maintain that neutrality?
I don't know. I always smelled Sidious behind the Nemoidians, because the Nemoidians as a species are cowards. They're sniveling, stunted slime, and there's just no nice way around it. So as a species, it's really, to me, easy to call me speciesist or something, but to lump them all into the same category, because they consistently are. And I think it's because of their greed that they're so manipulatable, if that's a word. But yeah, it's definitely something that I think would be interesting to explore more, because it's not really understood by the audience. It is kind of confusing as to whether or not all the Nemoidians, or at least they're part of the Trade Federation, are just overtly separatist and everybody's turning a blind eye, which is one way of looking at it, or if some of them are genuinely just greedy without the being evil part, which is kind of an oxymoron to itself.
Well, I did sort of sense a bit of conflict between the Nemoidian officers on the ship. Sort of some background tension over the issue.
Yeah.
What did you think, Eric?
Well, prior to the Jar Jar episode, I always thought the Trade Federation was with the Separatists for sure.
But yeah.
I don't know what to say. I can't decide until the whole
painting
story
me
is unraveled.
According to the Nemoidians from the Trade Federation, that in the episode, what they're obviously trying to say is that we're not all affiliated with them. It's just a couple. It's just a handful of them.
A handful of extremists.
Which could kind of draw some real life parallels, but we'll stay out of that. But no, you're right. It's something that it'd be very easy to assume that the Trade Federation was overtly part of the Separatists, but they do have representation in the Senate still, which I think shows you how corrupt the Senate is. But if I was just going to say my take on it as the information, I think they are overtly involved with the Separatist movement and are just hiding it, or the Senate is turning a blind eye because of backroom deals and stuff, not like our own world.
Or Palpatine influence.
Yeah, yeah. I like to bring one thing, and that is Chuchi and Ahsoka. Some very interesting interactions between those two. Evidently, they're old buddies. We've never seen it, but evidently they actually know each other. And I think that's really interesting. I think we might be in for another prequel episode.
Oh, gosh.
Which, actually, I wouldn't mind, because I want to know how they got intimate and how they know each other. It seems like they really knew each other. They're just interacting like old friends. And some great, great dynamics. And Senator Chuchi is yet another character that I really, really like. In the episode of, I believe, season 1 now, Trespass, introduced to a very young, unsure of herself politician who wasn't really sure. She just kind of wanted to give in to what the what people are telling her to do. But in the end, she does what's right. And I think that's what's so cool about Star Wars, are moments like that. And so I really like that. And so I think she, that was a continuation in this episode. She's definitely a very great character to see. And she was, she knows how to negotiate. She, dealt her way right out of to getting that, blockade gone at the end of the episode. Got a Lot Dodd stuck in a trap, and, she and Ahsoka made a very good team in that. Ahsoka's the one who fought her way in, rescued the kidnapped, children, and then, Chuchi was the one who actually got them out of the situation using diplomacy, using politics. And so I thought they made a very dynamic
and blackmail.
Duo. Yeah, and blackmail, pretty much. It was like, oh, well, you know what we know about you, you better let go. And so, yeah, I thought Chuchi was a really good character. I like her. I really like the voice actor that Jennifer Hale does for her phenomenal job. I mean, you wouldn't know it, but that's the same lady who does the voice of Ayla Secura. That's her.
Wow.
So it's a really, really, really
an
cool.
Interesting moment between Ahsoka and Senator Chuchi. I thought was when Ahsoka was doing her mind influencing trick, Senator Chuchi, you know, wasn't sure what was up with that. And I think it's an interesting point that in the Star Wars universe, everybody knows that there's Jedi and that they have the Force and they can do things with it, mind flips. But apparently, they don't really know the inner workings of the Force, what you can use it for. They're just like, mind influence and picking up stuff, or whatever.
Yeah, that kind of shadowed Luke in Episode 4, when Obi-Wan does that to the Sand Trooper.
Very much so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely an homage, another homage to the original trilogy. But Ahsoka used
that
the Force.
Actually is even a running theme in the books. Like, specifically, I'm thinking of the Karen Travis books, where some of the clone troopers are like, oh, you can use the Force for that? Whoa.
That's awesome. I really like the way Ahsoka's Force ability seemed to be very enhanced in this episode. Wherever it falls to the timeline, she does seem to be very well developed. Two mind tricks in a row. She also saved the day when Chuchi was about to be discovered by Lot Dodd and his cohorts, and she Force lifts her up into the air and holds her there, and they, of course, miss her.
While holding herself, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah, while holding herself up. So I thought that was a really, really interesting little
it's
eye
like,
can, if you will, yeah.
It's
called another tie-in to Episode 4, when Ahsoka makes a noise in the Cybertus ship, and the Nimbodian turns around, and then she runs by. That's a lot like when Obi-Wan is in the
That's
true. Does that.
This episode seems just so full of callbacks, though. It was a lot of fun because of it.
Yeah, it was very much like Episode 1 in the theme, but very much like Episode 4 in its homages and little things. Like, I remember they actually used Watto's dice from Episode 1 when they were gambling
yeah, right.
from Jabba's palace. Another little piece of eye candy for you.
It was slightly different, though. One side was black on this dice. Watto's was this red and blue.
That's true. It was a slight difference there.
Back to Ahsoka's Force trick, though. It's interesting to note how powerful Ahsoka is as a Padawan. We've rarely seen this type of power in other Padawans. I mean, not that there have been tons in the Clone Wars, but it will be interesting to see how powerful she could get once she's been trained for.
Right, yeah. I think that it's Anakin's teaching, where I think he feels that he has to push her as hard as he can, since he felt that Obi-Wan is more holding him back. I think that he doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want the Ahsoka's training to be, you know, be the same.
Yeah, he doesn't want to restrict Ahsoka, which actually could end up being a very bad thing. But yeah, it's one thing I always keep a close eye on is Ahsoka and Anakin's relationship as it evolves throughout the Clone Wars. Definitely something I think we should all be keeping an eye on, because the subtleties of their interactions, I think, could be very telling in the future. I think what we might not be realizing, if you don't watch these episodes closely, are little seeds that are planted that could come to fruition much, much later into season 4 or 5 or 6, even as they say there might be even more seasons now. But yeah.
Right.
You know, just a kind of random thought about Chuchi is that I had while I was watching this episode is really what Chuchi was in this episode and in season 1 of Trespass is kind of what Padme was meant to be. And I say that because I think Chuchi as a character works better than Padme. Padme is always, I get what she's supposed to be, and she's supposed to be that pure politician who's fighting for what's right, who's fighting for her own people, and which worked in episode 1, but she became so emotionally vulnerable in episode 2 and 3. She really just became the barefoot and pregnant wife in episode 3, and it's hard to buy her as a character, especially when
that's
she
a bad kind of, mental picture.
When she just kind of died at the end of episode 3, a very anticlimactic ending. And you know, I was sitting there just wanting her to pull out a blaster and start going at Anakin because Anakin's such a jerk in episode 3. And so I think Padme as a character was kind of weakened at points to where I didn't really buy her. And I was hoping the Clone Wars would do that better, but I don't think the Clone Wars has done what they could have done with Padme's character. However, Senator Chuchi is a very accomplished, very go-get-em type of character, and I really like the way she works. She's very much like Baron Papanoida in many similar traits.
Oh, yes. And the accent, too, is really great.
I think she's from New Zealand. She's a great actor.
Next episode is about Padme, so hopefully her character will develop more tonight.
Before we get to, you know, speculation, which... Doesn't Clone Wars start in like 7 minutes for you guys?
Yeah, well, yeah, after we record this, it starts pretty soon. But I watch it on delayed, so we're not in any particular huge hurry.
Okay, well, one point I have to make about Jennifer Hale, who you know voices Senator Chuchi, is that she also plays Bastila Shan in the Knights of the Old Republic game.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, another very strong female character. And I think that's something that Star Wars has always wanted, is a good, strong female character, and Padme just never has quite done it for me, but I do think the same.
I think she did to a degree, especially in episode 1.
Yeah, I would say that, yeah. We'll make an exception for episode 1. It was episode 2 and 3, and throughout the Clone Wars, where she's been kind of the tool for a plot, where it's, you know, let's go rescue Padme again and again. That happened a lot in season 1. And so I can see why... There's definitely room for more strong lead female characters, and Ahsoka's growing into that role. She certainly didn't start that way, but she is growing into that role, and Senator Chuchi's definitely into that role. So I really think that she and Ahsoka made a good pair as far as the difference of their personalities, which they work together. And so really every time Ahsoka's not paired with Anakin is when she's the most successful in her mission, whether it's Luminara or the old guy in season 2 when she lost lightsaber.
She's always funny to notice, but she always seems to be asking different people besides Anakin for advice. Yeah. What do you guys think about that thought?
I think that maybe she doesn't want to let her master down. I think that's the main point. And I think that she maybe, you know, focuses less on the mission when she's working with Anakin than when she's working with someone else, because she has to focus on, okay, you can't let your master down, you know, don't mess up.
Padawan was the chosen one, and I imagine in the Star Wars universe that kind of comes back and hits her on occasion.
Yeah, it's kind of like she's the chosen one of the chosen one. So I think there's some pressure there, which makes her not really feel like she can confide in Anakin, because you might think that shows some kind of weakness. We all know Ahsoka's a very proud character, so I can definitely see how it's consistent with that when she does not really go to Anakin for advice. I cannot remember his name. If you guys, the master in Lightsaber Lost, Tara Sanube.
Sanube, yeah.
But he taught Ahsoka so much in that one episode. I thought that was very well done, and she learned so much from Luminara in her episode, and now alongside...
Or even her questions to Bear Sophie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, the kind of difference is Bear Sophie is kind of the straight-A student, the number one Jedi Padawan in the class that everybody likes.
Yeah, I mean, when she's asking Barriss Ophie what her master says about the Jedi's role in the war, and she says, well, my master Anakin says this, and Mace Windu says this, you know.
All right, so any closing thoughts on these episodes? I thought that it was great, and it wasn't really a story more... It wasn't exactly a story where it was a complex plot, but it was more of a character story, and I think that really showed through.
I had a really random thought.
Go for it.
Rodians have pretty eyes. I'm sorry, I can't help it. Every time I see a Rodian, I'm like, oh, they have such pretty eyes.
And goat people talk funny. I think that's what we learned. Now, we learned a lot from this episode, and I think if anything of the most unique part of this episode was the family dynamic between Baron Papanoida and his children. That's something we have not seen at all in Star Wars. Most family relationships, let's face it, are very, very strained.
Oh, yeah.
I have a quick
You're
question.
My heart!
Okay, that just made my ears really hurt. Wow.
But no, family relationships are very strained in Star Wars, and to see this family dynamic, not just, you know, Happy sitting around the living room fire reading bedtime stories to his daughters. No, this is a kidnapping, and Baron Papanoid is going after his daughters, and he's just out there and after them and taking names, and, you know, it's just epic stuff.
What do you guys think of this idea? Baron Papanoid sort of reminded me of what a good guy version of Cad Bane would be. The double shooting blasters,
yeah.
The quiet voice, his presence, his persona.
Well, yeah, that's definitely a cool thought.
What we don't know is that Cad Bane is a shapeshifter, and and Nightlife says, as a baron from a Plantora.
Pandora!
Ah, Pandora, Plantora, Pantora, I'm so confused.
He's been... Ah!
Next thing, we'll I want to hear Corey Burton sing his own rendition of ICU. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I have to make a quick comparison to Baron Papanoida and Hondo Ohnaka. I thought that they really, some of their personality traits didn't really fit with their professions.
Yeah.
I mean, because Hondo he's a pirate, but he has all this sense about honor. And, you know, Papanoida he's a diplomat, but, you know, he likes to get in gunfights and, you know, put knives up to Rodian's necks and stuff like that.
He's like, yeah, let's not wait for the police. Let's just kind of fly off. And...
Yeah, you're right. That's a brilliant comparison because Hondo Ohnaka, he has this sort of warrior code that one would maybe associate with the samurai or the ninjas or whatever. A very Eastern type of warrior code. And he's got this kind of gentlemanly aspect to him where we know he does seedy deals, but he has this sort of personal code of ethics, I think. Like it was so telling in season 2's in the finale episodes when you hear Hondo tell Boba, "Your father wouldn't have done it. Your father was honorable." I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he was saying, and it kind of implied that Hondo was chums with Jango Fett, which would be amazing to explore. And I think we have definitely not seen the end of Boba Fett and Hondo interacting, and I would, that's one thing that I would love to see more of. But you're right, bringing it back to Baron Papanoida in this episode, he's a politician. You know, you're expecting him to just kind of sit back, be fat, be paid in the, you know, you think of Star Wars politicians and you think of Orin Free Ta, you know, and Baron Papanoida, stark opposite. You know, he has really, really good blaster skills and has that same sense of honor, I think. And that's a really, really cool aspect. Something that you don't see not only in Star Wars, but in television and entertainment in general. So seeing this kind of honorable conduct, where the character himself, in the case of Hondo, may not be someone you would want to admire, you have to admire that he does have his own lines that he won't cross. And I think that's the case with, you're right, both Hondo and Baron Papanoida.
I was just thinking about Ion Papanoida, and I remember in an interview, George Lucas said something about Jet Lucas being a fan of Seth Green, and I wonder what that would be like for him to have, like, something he's a fan of playing him.
Yeah. It's not exactly the role I would like to see Seth Green in. I would love to see him come back as the droid, but I think Seth Green is definitely somebody I would love to see more and more in the Clone Wars. The guy's awesome, and We were at Celebration 5. Quick story. The year was 2010. And we were at Star Wars Celebration 5 at one of the Clone Wars panels, and one of the kids, you guys probably saw this on Twitter and on the website, but one of the little kids, all the little kids kept pestering Dave Filoni for little tidbits, and he hates to say no to little kids.
Is Ahsoka going to die?
Yeah. He's like, man, I don't know. You know, in his Dave Filoni voice. And this one kid has said, are we going to see any... Oh, wow, that's a terrible... I'll just do it in my own voice. Are we going to see any original trilogy characters in the in the Clone Wars? And there's a lot of heckling and cheering as Dave Filoni hesitated and would almost say something into the microphone, but then he'd look back at the PR person who was glaring at him. and so finally, I saw it myself. The PR person nodded, giving him permission to say something that he wasn't supposed to say because...
The crowd was really excited.
It made big enough news to where it was better to say something and give us, you know, throw us a scrap than to say nothing. Which, you know, that's the role of PR. They want to roll out information in bits to build excitement, and I understand that. So it was really cool to see Dave Filoni hesitate one last time, and the little kid said, "Don't hide what's inside."
The kid's like 8 years old.
I know. He's 8 years old. You're wondering, how this kid's got a script.
He brought
somewhere down
the house.
I know. The house went down and cheered. And then Seth Green ran across the front row up to the microphone, gave the kid a high five. This is Seth Green, by the way. Runs back to his seat. And the kid was just kind of completely, completely overwhelmed and bewildered. And then, of course, Dave Filoni gave us the little tidbit that there are going to be original trilogy connections. He didn't say characters. He said connections. In the Clone Wars, and I think we saw that in this episode.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great story.
Celebration memories!
Yeah, I know.
Those always seem to come out.
Memories! Yeah.
But do you think that there will be any more connections?
I think, wait, judging by the hesitation, definitely. I think we're going to see some major connections. Not just locations like we've seen in this episode, but I think we are going to see definitely more connections. I don't think he would have been that hesitant if that were not the case.
Yeah, so soon
Obi-Wan and Anakin crash on Corellia, and then Han Solo is going to help him rebuild a ship, and he's going to be like, "Where's the Hydro Spanner?" And then they're going to fly away.
Hydro Spanner! Hurry, get us out of here!
Yeah, I wouldn't be too surprised. I would not be too surprised. But yeah, the Clone Wars Season 3 has definitely developed a whole lot from Season 2, and we're really seeing it in this episode.
Do you think so far that it has surpassed Season 1 or 2?
I would say so, actually, especially from an animation standpoint.
Absolutely, yeah.
I would say Season 1 for sure, but not so sure about Season 2. There were a lot of great episodes in Season 2.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I think I'm thinking more in terms of anticipation, because I do think we are in store for a lot of really cool things, but I'm not really too... at this point, maybe not, because we are only 4 episodes in and beginning our 5 episodes here on the East Coast.
Once we see Savage Opress and the Night Sisters...
Yeah.
Oh,
and all that new stuff, I think we're going to be able to say that the season was the best so far.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to seeing Satine again. That'll be interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of digging up graves in the EU community and in the vernacular of Jason Plank. Burm, 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 burm. Another one.
Satine's a new outfit this season, but I guess Anakin and all those guys, they can't change at all.
Yeah.
Unless they're going to a really cold planet.
I guess not. I mean, we saw Chuchi in a fabulous costume change, but we have Anakin and Obi-Wan not so much. Of course, they have changed the models. They have actually replaced the models from Season 1 and 2. And it's more subtle, but you can kind of see it, especially in Asajj Ventress in the episode. You could see her facial expressions were a lot more realistic, and I think that's definitely very telling.
Complex.
You can see Obi-Wan's hairstyle is slightly different if you look closely. A few little details, but no radical costume changes. Although,
by the way, are they Pantorans or Pantorians?
Pantorans?
I think three syllables, Pantorans.
Okay. Well, anyway, I really liked the Pantorans costumes. Those are neat costumes.
They kind of had a medieval...
I'd love for them to explore their culture a bit more.
Yeah. It does have a very distinctly kind of medieval princess look, at least in the case of the daughters, with all the gold headgear and Papanoida. Papanoida has a distinctly kind of Arabian look. He almost has a turban atop his head.
Yeah.
Really, really cool. And I think that's kind of telling as far as kind of honor system and warrior system. You could, like, call him could compare him to an Arabian knight of sorts.
Right. It would be really fascinating if they could go into a bit more detail with the Pantoran's culture.
Another little brief detail was, I believe it's Ion Papanoida, the son.
Right.
He carried a blaster that looked distinctly like a Colt 45. If you look at the episode guide and go through the slideshow and look closely, he's got a distinct Colt 45, and he's wearing what could almost amount to a Confederate Civil War style uniform.
I noticed that. I'd forgotten it though.
Yeah, he's got even the gold trim and the chest. Look, he could almost be Errol Flynn if you for a really old movie reference there.
I didn't catch that. I'm going to ask you to watch the episode again.
Yeah, that's the thing. You always do these conversations about the episodes, and you got to go watch them again.
Which is very curious, because his Ion's shirt or tunic or whatever is very military reminiscent, the way it crosses over his shoulder and stuff. And that's very interesting for a family that's in politics. Once again, it's making me dying of curiosity. I want to see more of the culture.
All these little visuals, they can really pique your curiosity.
Right. Definitely.
When Lot Dodd mentions the Treaty of 1647...
Curiosity! Dying of it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
They could have a whole episode on that.
Clone Wars Season 4, Episode 7, The Tale of the Blue Faces. It's a trap.
They keep time in Star Wars?
Oh, that's true. They did use our dating system.
The Treaty of 1647, right? Some 20 years before Christopher Columbus entered the Ocean Blue, yes.
That was 1492, Riley.
I know, I said before.
But it would be after 1647. Okay, sorry.
I stand corrected.
What else we got? Are we finished here?
I think we pretty much covered everything. They're certainly looking forward to the rest of Clone Wars Season 3 as it continues underway right now.
Yeah, we're sorry we're keeping you guys.
No. We watch it on tape. We tape it first. It's too many scenes that you have to, like, pause and rewatch and go back again. And
be humble. We don't have cable.
Okay, yeah. And we don't have cable. But no, really, it does make a huge difference. It's so much more fun, whether it be iTunes, to watch the episode all the way through with no commercial breaks. It really, I think, does make a difference, especially the weird Cartoon Network commercials, to be honest.
Yeah, their commercials seem to take forever.
Yeah.
Benton Alien Force, you know, you hear like the Clone Wars actors doing a lot of these advertisements.
I know.
Now you can purchase the new Transformers Waveform.
Yeah.
Destroy, build, destroy.
It's too fun to do that voice.
And now, back to the Clone Wars.
Riley, I just got a compliment on your impressions.
Oh. I know, I'm kind of having maybe a little too much fun tonight.
One day you'll surpass James Arnold Taylor.
Oh, I doubt that. James Arnold Taylor is the man. I cannot do... I couldn't even try. I won't dare even pretend. But no. Thanks for the compliment. I appreciate it. Hey, if you need someone doing an audio drama out there needs a goat guy or a bad Tom Kane impression, that's your man.
Okay, so you guys over at the Bothan Report, have a really good show, and why don't you give us some contact details?
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
And thanks so much for having us on.
Yeah,
this has been great fun.
Thank you for coming on. It was a blast.
So nice of you to give us the invitation. Yeah, definitely. We're just in the beginning stages. Fairly new. The newest solosound.net podcast is the Bothan Report. What we do is kind of a monthly look at the latest Star Wars news. We usually only pick a couple of the big topics and really go in depth to discuss them, and We have, the latest episode is a little bit controversial, shall we say. We talk a lot about continuity and really just fandom in general and when and why and how you like Star Wars. So some broad questions that anyone in the community might be interested in. You can find us over at solosound.net, along with a bunch of other quality Star Wars programming. I should do that in my Tom Kane. With a lot of other quality Star Wars programming. But yeah, you can find us at solosound.net, where you can get all the rest of our contact info, but especially Facebook and Twitter and iTunes. These are the three ways. And let me say this. It's, as a podcaster, I know, let me give you guys a plug, because if we go to this trouble because we're passionate about it, but it makes it so much more worth it when we hear feedback from the fans. So if you're listening to this, all you Fanboys Guide to the Galaxy listeners, this is a guilt trip. If you have not given them a review on iTunes, not emailed them, and you have some thought while you're listening to their show, definitely send them an email. And the same goes for us. As far as we go, I always love it when we get any kind of feedback. And so definitely, it only takes a few minutes of your time, and we do put many hours into podcasting about the stuff that we're passionate about, and we do enjoy it, but it's always a little icing on top of the cake when we get emails and Twitter responses and iTunes reviews, all those sorts of feedback. So to all of you listeners out there, there you go. Do it. It is your destiny.
Ah, yes. And remember, many Bothans died to bring you this podcast. gotta throw in our trademark.
There you go.
GalaxyFanboy@yahoo.com.
It's Lead Voice.
There you go. Nice.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you, guys. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter now. We have a Twitter handle. It's @GalaxyFanboy. And then you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/GalaxyFanboy. You can email us at GalaxyFanboy@yahoo.com. And that's it.
Do it. As your guest, I
do it.
And you.
All right. Well, thanks, guys.
I awake at nights, tossing and turning.
With the evil vision of your mother perishing in the Tusken Raider camp. Send an email. How's that for incentive?
We're going to creep out your listeners.
I know. Last time we're on the show.
This podcast is not endorsed by Lucasfilm Limited or 20th Century Fox, and is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. Star Wars, all names, sounds, and character, or any other Star Wars-related items are the registered trademarks of Lucasfilm or the respective trademark or copyright holders.